Hello, everybody. Katie, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really an alcoholic. And I think that the biggest gift that I ever got from God, I think, was finally learning that I'm an alcoholic. And I don't have any doubts about it anymore. My sobriety date is 11-11-11. So kind of like Cody's, only it's the 11th and not the 1st. And Cody, where are you? I loved your story. That's awesome. I'm really grateful to be here tonight and honored to be able to tell my story. It's amazing that I would be asked to stand up in front of a group of people and share my story. For a long time, I didn't think that I really, I didn't really think that I got AA because I relapsed a lot for many years. I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 17 years. I'm just really grateful to be standing here tonight. Grateful to be alive. And I guess I'll start my story. I was born into a family of alcoholics, a long line of them. My great-grandfather died of cirrhosis when he was 50 years old, so I came by it genetically. And alcohol was always around, and I didn't think that it was anything abnormal. Lots of wine, lots of liquor, lots of everything, and I just thought it was completely normal because the people in my family, they were pretty, I guess, high-functioning alcoholics. They managed to drink a lot and live their lives. They didn't get arrested. They didn't seem to have any real consequences. So, I just thought that that's how to live. I remember my mom, every time she got in the car to go anywhere, if she weren't going to work, she would always have a drink in the car. And so that was just the way that she lived. I also remember my mom being, like, on the weekends and stuff, I hung out a lot by myself and did a lot of things alone because my mom was just drinking. One of her favorite pastimes was to lie out in the sun, and I would just explore outside. I hung out with my dad's bird dogs. I would go for trips around the golf course, and occasionally my mom would get phone calls like, your daughter's in our pool, like, you know, five houses down. And one time I took my my dog Dixie to Disney World, and we didn't quite make it, but I remember my mom beat the crap out of me when she found me, too, and so that was a little confusing, but that was, you know, kind of how it was. I was kind of a loner, and I spent a lot of time alone outside in the outdoors, and I had a great imagination, and so I would build these little fantasy worlds, and you know, pretend the dogs were like people, and I had a great time. I really loved growing up. I later got horses. So the story, Cody, about the sting, I remember when I was a kid, and we had just come back from a rodeo, and I was in the truck with some guys, and I got a wasp sting, and they're like, pull over, you know, and I didn't get a beer, but they were like, all right, pull your shirt up. It was on my back, and this dude just like spit out a big wad of tobacco and like rubbed it all over my wasp sting. I was like, really gross. So you got a better end of that bargain, man. I bet the beer would have been a lot better, and I don't think the nicotine or whatever it was supposed to did not work. It still stung, and it was just gross and awkward because it was only guys, and I mean, it was just really weird. But I haven't thought about that in so long. But thanks. So that was growing up. I mean, I had a great little life growing up as a kid. I guess it was a little awkward. I didn't have a group of friends. There was like the clique of girls. I grew up in a small town, and there was a clique of girls, and they were all like, you know, short and skinny, and I was tall, and I always felt like kind of like a big oaf, and I felt like a dork, and I didn't really fit in or anything. And my teachers would send home marks like unsatisfactory, does not listen. So unsatisfactory in listening. I talked excessively. I was messy. I didn't follow directions. I mean, that was just me, and I just was kind of odd. And I remember my mom telling me, you're not like other people. And so I grew up with thinking that. I mean, my mom told me, you know, she told me things like, you're not like others. You're special. There's something different about you. And then she would say, you know, you're so smart. You can do anything in the world. You can do anything. And I really, like, growing up thinking that you can do anything, that has really kind of sucked because I actually have limitations. And I found that out later in life. You know, I really thought that I could do anything, and I've succeeded, and I've done well, and I've, you know, made good grades and gotten jobs and whatever. But there are certain things that I'm not good at, and I can't do. And to discover that late in life, and to not—I mean, I had to learn to be gentle on myself and like, wow, I can't do everything. I mean, I'm just not learning this shit, and. And I'm glad I'm learning it, but I also have a daughter. I have a 14-year-old daughter, and I told her. I remember when I finally realized there was this one particular thing that I really couldn't do, and I wasn't going to be able to do it. And I came home that day, and I was like, you know what, Meryl? I said, you know, there are some things in life that you're going to be able to do, and some things you can't. And I was like, you know, the kid that can draw, and he's like amazing drawer, and he can just like doodle or draw anything. You know, wouldn't you like to be able to do that? But if you try. You don't have that same gift, and almost like there are assets and things we're good at and things we're not good at, and it's okay, you know. Just find the things you're good at and do those. And so these little lessons that I learn, and I try to teach my daughter things that I wish I had learned when I was her age. So being sober, and that's one of the great gifts of sobriety is that I can learn these lessons and I can pass them on. And you know, my mom, she did not teach me things because, you know, she was trying to withhold the secret of the universe from me or anything. She just, she did the best she could, you know, and God love her. So anyway, that was kind of off on a tangent. Middle school, I had, you know, I was taking the bus to my barn every day and, you know, riding the horses and whatnot. I was in the chorus and did pretty well in school, had one best friend, and things looked pretty, you know, nothing real abnormal. But I remember the Nancy Reagan Just Say No to Drugs campaign, and I just remember sitting there, and, you know, I told you about the imagination and wanting to explore and all these, like, you know, just my mind went wild with things. But I remember they did these brief little things about different drugs, so marijuana, heroin, LSD, cocaine, and I just remember sitting in the chair thinking, I want to try that. I want to really try that. I mean, and I wasn't hanging out with a bad group of kids. There were probably some, I don't know if there were, but there may have been kids already using and drinking or whatever, but I wasn't part of that. I just really wanted to feel how it said that I would feel if I did that. And I remember the LSD, that was the one I really, really wanted to try. And, you know, so my first drunk, my family had a hunting camp, and we were all out, you know, that's another thing. I had all boy cousins, and I was very competitive, and so I shot deer and did all of that stuff, and I tried to do anything like they could do. I had four older cousins, and I just wanted to fit in with them and to prove that I could be just as bad and whatever, like, cool as they were, and so they were drinking one night. All the parents had gone to bed, and they're like, let's get Katie a drink. So they poured me what was called a Long Island iced tea. It wasn't really a Long Island iced tea. It was just every kind of liquor mixed in a red Solo cup with Coca-Cola, and that was my Long Island iced tea, and I drank it, and I remember sitting there, and I remember the feeling that I got sitting around, and I was getting that buzz for the first time. I was probably 12 or something like that. And I just started feeling like this kind of like mean, like, I'm going to show you MFers and I'm going to get drunk. And I got that feeling, like, I'm going to show you. And I got, and I drank it all, and I was like, I want another one. And they weren't having another one. They were just kind of sipping on theirs. And I drank it all, and I'm like, I want another one. And I did, and I blacked out. And I don't remember really what happened, but I know the next day I woke up and I didn't feel good, but I didn't show it to my mom or anything because I didn't want to get in trouble. And I'm sure they probably had some idea, but, you know, denial, they didn't want to have to deal with that, I guess. So just was never found out. That was my first drunk, and I don't remember the next drunk, but I know that that's how I drank. I just drank. When I had the buzz, my personality changed, and I did things that I wouldn't have done if I'd been sober. And I drank like that, like with a vengeance. As soon as I got a little buzz, I was just wanting more. And so, of course, you know, being a new drinker, it was really ugly. A lot of the times, a lot of vomit, a lot of, you know, consequences. Like, I did things like vandalize shit and the police. You know, here I am, the show choir student, getting called in the police officer. Well, ma'am, we know that you scratched this girl's car, and now you're going to have to pay for the paint job. And so those are the kind of things that happened. Just like my life was totally, it was just off. Here you have this picture of this person, and then these things that I would do just completely did not match. Just weird shit. I remember I was in English. I have a degree in English. I was a very good writer. But I remember in honors English or something, just some stupid thing that I did. I plagiarized this portion of a group project, and I got the book out of a college library, so I ripped the page out because they could never prove that I plagiarized, right? Well, of course, I guess it sounded a little too good, and they look for the book, and of course the page is missing, and then of course there, you know, there is another book somewhere in another library or something. They probably had the same book in that library. I don't even know. I didn't check that, but yeah. So I was like stacking. Like I had to go do service work in my honors English class, and another time I geometry. I was just another stupid thing. Like we used to all like look at each other's test answers and share, you know, answers back and forth because I did not study. I had the easy way out. I did really well. If I paid attention in class, I would, you know, I would do very well. I mean, I would make A's on tests if I just listened, and I could do the vocabulary stuff. I'd read it one time, like, before my test and make hundreds, and things came really easy to me. So I could just do the minimal amount of work and get, you know, okay grades. And so geometry, I'd, like, look over and get this answer, and I put it down, and this is the day. Like, I remember Mr. whatever his name was, I don't even know, but he was such a nerd, this teacher. He had his little glasses on, and he came in, and he sat up on his desk, and he was, like, swinging his feet back and forth. He was like, guess what, students? He was like, last week was my little honesty check, and so everybody had gotten a different test. And so, of course, my answer was, you know, somebody else's answer and for the other test. And so I got, you know, in trouble for that. So those are the kind of dumb things that I did. Not real, like, blatant criminal stuff, but just really dumb things that I didn't even have to do, you know. But I did them anyway. And I felt really stupid. And getting high and drinking and stuff, like, took that all away. I was kind of like, you know, I had a nickname, Shady Katie. Because I would just disappear on weekends because I hung out with these like older people, random people, and I would just freon and weird stuff, like, you know what I mean, like in people's barns and like just weird stuff. Meanwhile, I was still in show choir, and I don't know. So high school, I hated it. I really did. I remember my senior year. We went, or it was Christmas or something, I don't know, snuck out and went to a rave, and that changed my life for a long time because I discovered a couple of different, or a particular one substance that I really started doing quite a lot of. But I remember the music, and it was just like, I guess it was just completely as far away from reality. I had done the LSD. I finally tried that like in ninth grade, and that was it. I remember when I was tripping the first time with like Peter Frampton, and I'm watching this, like looking at this, yeah, Peter Frampton, looking at this surf poster, and like the waves were moving, and I was like, oh, and I was like, I want to stay like this forever. I did. I wanted to stay like that forever, and you know, I tried, kind of. So anyway, the rave thing, and I just loved that. Like, I loved being as far out of the universe and just, like, total weird, like, music and lights and all kinds of stuff. Like, that's what I really enjoyed that. And so I went off to college. I made it one semester. I came home, and there were more of these rave things that I was involved with, and I lost my mind because I, just like I drank, that's the way that I did hallucinogenic drugs. And, you know, there's a limit. You don't black out when you take too much of this stuff. It's like the opposite. I couldn't go to sleep anymore, and it got really weird. And so I was actually somehow convinced to go back home to my family's house. You know, all the cousins, the hunting, and the, you know, pretty conservative family, and it's Christmas, and I come in, and they said, we think you might need help. And I was like, what do you mean? I was like, you know, I did not need help. I was like, you know, I was in another place. And I said, no, I don't need help. And then I look in the corner, and I see two police officers, and in my grandparents' home. And so my immediate reaction was to run out the back door. And so literally, this is such a weird story, but I was running outside around the house, and they ran after me and tackled me down, and they shackled me up on the ground in front of my entire family. And I was literally biting onto a piece of shrubbery as hard as I could, like, no, like, I'm not gonna go, you know. And like, they ripped me off, and I had that shit in my mouth, and they threw me in the back of the cop car, you know. And I like sit up, and there's my whole family. And you know what I thought? They're traitors. The last thing in the world I thought was, wow, you know, look at my part. How did I, you know, that was not what I was thinking. I was thinking, these people are the enemy, and I swear to God, I will never, like, F them, you know. I was so mad, and little did I know what was in store for me. Went to Largo from Sebring. I guess we didn't have a charter-like hospital in Sebring, so I got transported in the back of the cop car to Largo, to a charter hospital, and I was Baker acted or Myers or whatever act it is. And when I discovered that I didn't have my shoes on, and they locked the door, and I'm in there, and I'm like, okay, they just let you go. I mean, they just let me go once I was in, and then I'm trying to get out, and the door was locked. And then I was like, oh, maybe if I put my shoes on, then I'll be able to go out. And so I was like, give me my shoes. I need my shoes so I can leave. And then it was when I wasn't going to leave. And I did not like that once I discovered that I was locked up inside of a place. This is the first time in my life I've ever been restrained like that. I ended up getting tackled again and, you know, Thorazine. And, you know, woke up a little drowsy later. And then I figured out, okay, here's how I get out of this. You know, I just got to follow the rules and do what they say. My first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I don't even know what, I don't know. I went to an AA meeting, and I was like, I don't know what they said. I just knew that I did not need to be there, and it was like, how do I get out? That was the only thing that I was worried about, and I just did whatever I had to do. I remember I, like, let out a whole bunch of family secrets to the counselors and, like, you know, brought up some childhood issues that I had with my cousins, and I laid it all out there, like, I'll show them, I'm gonna, you know, whatever. I blamed everybody for everything, and then I passed the limit where then I was in there voluntarily, and I called my boyfriend, the drug dealer boyfriend that I had hooked up with when I was up at the girls' college. I went to a Converse College, which is in Spartanburg, South Carolina, an all-girls school. And it wasn't really for me. But anyway, so I called him, and I was like, hey, you got to come get me. So he drove down, and he had a 40, because they sold those in Georgia, and a blunt. And I was like, I'm out of here. I remember the guy looked at me, one of the therapists, and he's like, you'll be back. Be back to a place just like this. And I was like, yeah, right, never gonna come back. So I mean, that was just my first little experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. After that, I moved in with a guy, just a long, crazy, like, if I, let's just say 12 psych wards. I was arrested 5 times. I did things that I never planned on doing. I didn't plan on becoming a junkie or using needles, and I did that. I didn't plan on smoking crack, and I did that. I sold those types of things and literally saw someone almost die, someone that I had literally sold and given the stuff to. Luckily we were at this guy's house that knew that we should just throw him in the shower and put ice on him, and it he was literally on the couch gurgling and turning blue, and I thought I'd killed him. And if he had died, I would have killed him. Would have been me. But he didn't die. And shortly after that, this was with a guy that I had met lots of treatment centers later. It was 1998. And I left Healthcare Connection against medical advice to move in with this guy that I met at John Calvin Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And that's what I did. And and then I got pregnant on purpose. And I was like, let's have a baby. I'm ovulating. And 2 weeks later, I had to kick dope, and I was messed up. My family didn't want to have anything to do with me, and I moved in to his sister's trailer in Plant City, and I got a job at a convenience store. And my husband buffed body jewelry for a living. He was on house arrest. The story, I mean, it was whack, but amazingly, I mean, this is funny. I would just die if my daughter knew this, like, seriously, because she's the best thing that ever happened to me, saved my life. I got it together. I stopped smoking, stopped doing everything. I joined the church choir. I did all kinds of stuff, and I was a really good mother. I nursed her for a year, and, you know, I did really well. And my husband, he became my husband. He got off house arrest, and he got a job. We moved to Orlando, and I decided I didn't want to be married to him anymore. Selfish, self-centered, self-seeking. Left him and started using and drinking again. Same kind of things happened. Go back to Healthcare Connection again, except this time my daughter was taken away from me. It was very clear that I had a problem. But I wish I could say that I got sober after that. I stayed sober for a year and went back to school. And, like, on my year anniversary, I was like, see, you know what? I don't really need AA, because if I really was an alcoholic, I wouldn't have gone a whole year without drinking. So I, like, popped a couple pills and drank on my year anniversary, and, you know, a couple DUIs later, things like that. I don't know. I mean, I get really caught up. Like, my life was really, really crazy and chaotic, and so whenever I'm asked to tell my story, it just kind of gives me a sick feeling in my stomach, because I don't even like to go back to all this stuff, and I'd like to just brush over it all and get sober. But it took me a long time to get sober. A lot of crazy shit happened. I got sober finally in 2000, I don't know, 8 or 9 or something like that. Stayed sober for a couple years, and then I relapsed because of a guy. I had a job. I had a degree. I was traveling all over the country, and I stopped going to meetings so much. And I drank again. And I was kind of hiding it, not really sober. And then 2010, my mom committed suicide. She couldn't stay sober. She had tried, and she was also addicted to benzos and went to detox a couple of times over at Town and Country, and the doctors would put her on shit and stuff, and she shot herself in 2010. the Wednesday before Mother's Day and a month before my brother's wedding, and it was horrible, as you can imagine. I didn't drink when that happened. I stayed sober for a little while, but I got really, really angry at God and angry at AA. And I would hear people my mom's age that had it or got it or had stayed sober, and I was like, F them. They got it. My mom didn't. I'm just like her. I'm not going to be able to get it either, and so screw it. And I went back out for about 9 months. And within those 9 months, I quit my job, my career. I decided to go back to school to be a graphic designer. I got back together with an ex of mine and married him. And I mean, a lot of major life changes without any real direction or, you know, I just did this with total self-will stuff. And then, you know, after I got, you know, we were married, I was going to throw in, let's just still kind of break it up a little bit. I was going to, it's really serious and sad sounding, the Pink Floyd t-shirt. Like, I was going to say, like, I missed two concerts. I went to the Grateful Dead, the last show they played at the Omni before Jerry Garcia died, and then I saw Roger Waters' The Wall, and I had done so much LSD that I don't even remember any of it at all whatsoever, like, big blur. Like, the kind of things that I would did, like, we took a tour bus to that Dead show, and the liquid acid flipped over on the counter, and I licked up the puddle. And, you know, like, that's the kind of crazy shit, you know, you see people that could manage their stuff, and, like, they would be like, man, that's too much, what are you doing, like, that's stupid, and, I mean, I just was such a, like, somebody said, you're a born rager, and, you know, just dumb stuff, but, I don't know where that came to, the Roger Waters concert happened in that last 9 months, and, but that's the kind, you know, my alcoholism, you know, I talk about the drugs, and because you guys are young and you did them too, and so I can, I guess, talk a little more freely about it because it's a big part of my story, but alcohol brought me to my knees. Alcohol was what I had to have. I drank alone, I blacked out, and I said hideous things to people in blackouts. That whole mean thing that I told you about the first time I drank, it continued and got worse, and I got violent, physically violent, and I married my husband, and I was blacking out and saying horrible things and doing horrible things, and I knew that I had to stop drinking, and I couldn't stop, like Cody said. I was like, oh, all those other times that I went into AA, and it was just easy, and it was like, oh, I got this. Man, it was really, really hard. I couldn't stop obsessing about alcohol. It was so, so hard, and I finally stayed sober for about 4 months, but I wasn't really following directions and putting other people's, you know, my grandfather was dying, and I was spending a lot of time down in Sebring, and my sponsor was like, are you going to meetings when you're down there? And I was like, oh, I'm fine. I just got to think about my grandfather. You know, that's the most important thing right now. And when he died, I drank at his funeral, and I knew, I'm like, I'm so powerless, and I got to follow directions. I got to listen to what these people say and just do it. And I had a lot of spiritual, my higher power. I mean, I had a very these cool ideas about God, but it wasn't helping me stay sober. And so my God to me became a group of drunks. And then it became good, orderly direction. And for the first time in my life, I'm able to take direction. I think that I've finally gained some humility because I see that I am lacking in a lot of just things that block me from being of service to others, things that block me from my higher power, things that just cause me anxiety and make me feel like an insane person, just completely unnecessary things that I do. I have this, you know, step seven, I heard last night, step seven is like step three on steroids. And I always thought, you know, I tried the steps because I would come in and I'd be like, do the steps. And it didn't work. Nothing changed. And so my faith in this program kind of sucked because it wasn't working for me. And what I've come to learn with outside help, like therapists and things that I've discovered that I really need, is that recovery is a process. This is a process. There's no magic 1, 2, 3. It's just all going to work. It's just things take time. You know, humbly asking him to remove my shortcomings. I ask God, and I believe I ask God, and he's doing them. And he's doing it through other people. Just finally getting honest and being able to kind of see my reactions, my behaviors, my mannerisms, the way that I talk to other people, and the same kind of patterns over and over again. Just being able to look at those and take an honest inventory and to see where I need help. I finally have a sponsor that I feel like I can actually call up and talk to. I've had just as many sponsors, I mean, almost as like if I've had white chips. I just think I just never really trusted, or I always really thought something was broken inside me, that I really just wasn't going to be able to get help. Like, I believed that people wanted to help me and they could help me, but I didn't think that I was capable of receiving it. And that's just bullshit. That's not true. This is a process, and I'm finally learning to trust it and to reach out for help when I need it. And I do have a higher power today. I have so many wonderful things. I have so many wonderful friends. Things that I'm doing right now. I just got a new job, and it's a local company. I've worked for companies like that, you know, are based out of other countries and whatnot. And so now I have a company that I work for that's local. And I went to a Rotary Club lunch the other day, and I got invited to the Rotary Club next week. And I went to the Tampa Bay Technology Forum networking group, and I'm going to go to the chamber. Like, I'm doing these things that I never in my life thought that I could do. My dad was a Rotary member, and I just thought he was like, you know, Andy Griffith. And I just thought I was not cut out of that mold, and I couldn't be anything. Why would the community want me to have anything to do with it? But you know what? I do feel like I can give back in many ways. I can give back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I can give back to my family. I was able to do my grandmother's eulogy, to sing at her funeral recently. I was there for my other grandmother in the hospital last weekend. I can show up and be of service today and not whine and pout about it and not just feel like so put out. I don't think that it's the most wonderful thing in the world to do, but I just try not to think about myself when I do it. And I've been able to see people die, and I realize life is really short. And, you know, I just want to do what I can one day at a time. And I have limits. I'm just a human being. There's nothing special about me. I'm just like the other people in this room. And, you know, I pulled into, like, just, I'm thinking, like, on my way here, like, what am I going to say? I need to have this message. It's profound something. Or I pulled up into Starbucks because I needed to get my decaf coffee, and it was, like, 7:13, and I'm boxed in, and it's really slow. The line isn't moving at all, and I was like, what the? What, you know what I mean? Like, I'm feeling the rage just, like, boil up inside of me. And I'm like, this is not spiritual, and I'm going to tell my story at this meeting. And then I'm like, holy shit, but you know what? I can see today that it was a choice. I had the choice to pull into the parking lot and get out of my car and walk in, or I can go into this lane. And I made this choice not because I thought it would be shorter. I didn't feel like getting out. It was just one of those things, like kind of like the two roads diverged in Yellowwood thing. But anyway, I went through, and then I'm boxed in. And I'm like, you know what? I had made this choice. And I'm thinking about the other people in this line that are also maybe late for something. And I'm thinking, and I'm looking in there. Looks like they're talking, and I'm, like, judging and trying to, you know. But then I stop because I'm like, you know what? They're people. Every single one of those people in that Starbucks that's working there is a person, a human being, and they're working. And they are not thinking about me or trying to keep me from where I'm going. It's not about me, you know? And so I guess I'll just leave it at that. Thank you so much for letting me share.